James takes his jacket off, which means he's in a fighting mood tonight. You ready for that? I just can't tell you what an honor it is to be at the 92nd Street Y. I know all the luminaries you've had before, and I hope we don't let you down. And I know we won't when we bring out our guest, the Honorable William Bradley, in a few minutes. But first of all, I thought maybe somebody here might have a little bit of interest in what's going to happen in 47 days. Anybody? Well, there's no one better to talk about that than my dear friend and colleague and the great sage, James Carville. And by the way, on October the 5th on CNN, there will be a documentary on James Carville that got a rave reviews at the Telluride Film Festival. So everybody watch it then. James, we got a lot to talk about, including, close your ears, a sex scandal in North Carolina. But let me just first give the state of the presidential race right now, less than 50 days out.
Well, first of all, again, echo what you said. I think it's the third or fourth time I've been here. It's probably the greatest event venue in the United States. I say that not in all honesty. Look, this thing is tight. And if any Democrat is feeling really bullish, let me knock it right out of you. All right, we have a lot to do. And don't ask me to explain, but you saw the poll today in the New York Times that comports with three different good private polls I got today. That's about where we are, 47-47. And remember, well, we can talk about it, but the Democrat has to win the popular vote by 2 or 3 points. So whenever you see a number, you can just deduct 2.5. So that's great. We had a great convention. We had a great debate, and we tied. And that's just the way it is. It doesn't do me any good to come here and bullshit you and tell you that I don't have any idea who's going to win. I think if we execute certain things and have more discipline, I think we can win. But this is a long way from an election that anybody is remotely ready to call in either direction.
James, I totally agree with you on the fact that this is a tight election. I slightly disagree on the fact that the Democrats have to win by, you know, 2 or 3. I think that was the case before. Okay. But, you know, we had on, what was his name, Michael Podhoretz,
right,
who knows as much about this as anybody, and he kind of poo-poos that. I think there's a slight electoral college advantage for the Republicans, but a lot of the 2 or 3 is based on what happened in 16. And, you'd like to win by enough of a margin, you don't worry about it. But I don't really care what her margin is in California or New York, but I care a lot about what her margin is in Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
Well, maybe it's 1.5. Okay? But I understand.
He's moving in the right direction.
This
folks.
Is not, I know this audience, it doesn't tend toward good news. They'd rather you be a little bit more on the bad news side, and we can adjust downward, all right? But whatever it is, I see too much giddiness, and that's just not true. Where we are in this election at all. And there's only one way I've ever done my whole career in politics, there's only one way I ever run, and that is scared. And I'm going to be 80 on election day, and I'm unlikely to change. I'll always run scared.
I would just remind everyone that he's the kid on this panel, so it kind of does where we are. I don't disagree with anything that James has said. Events sometimes can help you, or they can hurt you. I think there's an event that occurred today in North Carolina that I think is going to help Democrats. I usually don't believe in reverse coattails or bottom-up, if you will, but North Carolina Republicans have nominated such a crazy ticket the woman running for the head of education, public instruction, has publicly advocating executing Barack Obama at Guantanamo and putting it on pay for view. Now, you can't make that up. But their gubernatorial candidate, everybody thought was really bad. He said that women only have abortions because they can't keep their skirt above, you know, below their knees. I mean, he just really has said some dreadful things. But it got worse today, didn't it, James?
Yeah, it got much worse, and you should look at it. CNN broke the story. I'm sure they had a little help from some people who were in North Carolina. And the important thing to remember, the story was held until it was too late to get him off the ballot. But it's literally that bad. But what bothers me is this. We've had the following events. We had an energetic convention that would be very difficult to find anything wrong with it. We had a debate where, frankly, you couldn't help but think that we didn't just win. We won by more than a lot. He's had the craziest cats they ran a cartoon in the New Orleans paper when a hurricane was coming, said Louisiana is raining cats and dogs and Ohio they're eating cats and dogs. He's had the stupidest thing you can, and it's still tied. It's still tied. And, you know, today we got announcement of a 0.5-cent rate cut. We've had unemployment numbers that have been staggering. We've had growth numbers that have been staggering. Jamie Dimon, who reportedly knows something about this kind of stuff, says the best economy he's ever seen. But unfortunately, in spite of all of that, we're tied. And we have to understand that's where we are. I'm not saying we're not going to win or we're going to lose. I'm not saying anything like that. But what I am saying that I get a little frustrated like everybody else. I think we keep doing this, and I think it's going to change the structure of the race, and it comes back, and the structure of the race does not change. I think if you squint hard enough, you can find some evidence that our position has improved, maybe since Labor Day, but you'd have to squint pretty hard and look pretty hard to find that evidence.
Well, I'm more bullish, but I'll give you another bit of bad news that you all may think is insignificant. But the Nebraska legislature, heavily Republican legislature, Nebraska is one of two states that decides the electors by congressional district, and the other is Maine. And the Republican, Lindsey Graham, has been flying out there. Lindsey Graham, he used to be the John McCain-loving Republican who suddenly found a new daddy. And he's out there, and they are going to try to change that law, and they may succeed. And the thinking always beforehand, well, if they change it, Maine will change it. But Maine's up against a deadline, which they may not be able to constitutionally able to change it. You say, oh, come on, who cares about one district? It's not a crazy scenario. We don't know what will happen. I think James has made that point in the final 7 weeks. But if Harris wins the so-called blue wall, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and loses the South in Arizona and Nevada, and if she wins that one district, which Biden won last time, that's 270 electoral votes. She loses that one district because of change in Nebraska law, that's 269 electoral votes. And guess what? That goes to the House. And who has a majority of delegations in the House? Probably the Republicans. So I think that really reinforces your point, James, that this is nobody should be overconfident or engaged in hubris right now. What do you look for in the next month or so?
Well, we have a okay favorability ratio, which I'd look for. There's been some improvement. The enthusiasm number is comparable. I've seen some. I don't like you got to look at an aggregate of polls, and you got to look at the better ones a little more than the other ones. But everything is uncomfortably close. And it's uncomfortably close in spite of some pretty good news from the Democratic vantage point. And, you know, we think that his immigration argument is false and salacious and racist. Unfortunately, it's more popular than we like to believe. And any of you, I don't care what, this is the United States car 2024. The racism, nativism, and misogyny are still out there in the country. As much as we like to think that it's not, I'm here to tell you, it exists. And it exists in more than little pockets here and there. I'm not saying we can't overcome it. I'm not saying we can't win, but we're a long way from being able to state that with any kind of certainty. I don't want to get anybody thinking the wrong thing. I'm just scared. I'm uncertain. I feel like I got a job to do between now and Election Day. Whatever it is, I'm going to try to do the best I can, and then I'll think about it election night. But I can't allow myself to get paralyzed by this.
James, the presidential election is obviously the big one, but there's also incredibly important elections for Congress. The conventional wisdom, which occasionally is right, is that the Democrats face an uphill, near impossible task of keeping the Senate. It's 51-49 now. West Virginia is going to go R, which makes it 50-50, which means they have to win all their close seats. That's a very tough challenge. And yet there's kind of a sense that probably Democrats have the upper hand in taking back control of the House. What do you think of that conventional?
So I'll say this. There's 7 swing states. The most unlikely outcome is a break 4-3. Elections tend to break one way or the other. I'd say it's much more likely to end up 5-2 or 6-1. They end up 4-3. The other thing I'd say is generally the House and the Senate run in tandem. Now, the Senate map is really challenging. I have no doubt about that. I also think, and not many people agree with me, I think Florida is going to be a lot closer than anybody thinks. I think I have pretty good reasons to
think
on
both the presidential and the Senate?
Yes, both the presidential and the Senate. Maybe the Senate might be slightly, maybe the Senate candidate will run slightly ahead of the presidential candidate. But you got the abortion on the ballot, you got weed on the ballot, and they're getting killed by insurance rates. Homeowners, car insurance, everything is just off the charts in Florida. A lot of it is climate induced. But I do think that if there's 7 acknowledge swing states. I think Florida's probably, Florida, Texas, I can't tell you which one. We get our hearts broken there every 4 years. But I believe in keep trying. I'm more bullish on Florida than most people.
And you believe that abortion is still a big winning issue for Democrats?
We have not lost an election since Dobbs. That's one thing we got to get over.
We haven't lost a competitive election.
Right, yeah. I mean, state Senate seat in Alabama, we were supposed to lose by 23. We lost by 7. I don't count that as a loss. Okay, yeah. I mean, there's some seat in Nebraska, but basically anywhere that we've teed it up in a congressional race, a mayor's race, or even state legislative races, since Dobbs, the Democrats have way outperformed. Now, what people legitimately would say is, well, Trump's on the ballot, he changes everything. That may be true. But what's also true, we haven't lost in 2 years. And we didn't lose. And believe me, 2022 was a big Democratic win. Don't kid yourself. That went against history. And I think you're not going to get much disagreement from people that follow this closely. That was Dobbs on display. This is one powerful issue the Democrats have.
Well, if it wasn't a conflict of interest, I would put in a big plug for that race in Nassau County, New York 4, where my kid's working for the Democratic candidate. But I can't do that, can I, James?
No, hey, I can do it.
So I'm not going to mention Laura Gillen or New York 4.
That's it, Ben.
I am going to go and introduce our very special guest, and there will be time for questions afterwards. And I want to remind you the microphones will be on the left and on the right. And I think I got my left and right correct. And please ask a question. Don't make a statement, because between Bill and James, there'll be some good answers, I promise. But we are so pleased to be joined by a man who not only was a Rhodes Scholar, an NBA champion, a United States Senator, but and one of the most interesting people I have ever met in American politics, the Honorable Bill Bradley. Bill, let me start off. You did a one-person play on Broadway, which is now turned into a documentary and on YouTube, called Rolling Along After the Mississippi River. Now, to do a one-person play about yourself and your career, you really have to have done something special. And I'm just thinking of the Bill Bradley bio. He was a banker's kid from Crystal City, Missouri, who wintered in Palm Beach and became an All-American basketball player. He went not to Duke, where All-American basketball players go, but instead he goes to Princeton, you know, for the big Brown rivalry. And then instead of just being content with the Ivy League, he goes, takes him to the NCAA and sets a scoring record. But after that, it's going to be big bucks, because you're ready. I mean, you know, he's become a star, even if it is Princeton. And instead he goes to Oxford to become a Rhodes Scholar. And then he is going to go, but he's going to play for the New York Knicks, who've never won a championship in the history of the NBA, and they win two. And we're looking for things special that he's done. And then you go and you run for the Senate, supposedly against a popular incumbent Republican who gets beaten in the primary, and you serve 18 years, and you're one of the few people in your first term, or the latter part of your first and being the second, who really is a driving force behind a major piece of legislation. That's rare. And then you run a close presidential race, and you go on to become a very successful investment banker. So why is the Bill Bradley story worth the documentary?
Good question. Well, you know, it's called Rolling Along on YouTube, and it's my American story. I remember I showed it, and a few people asked them, what do you think this is about? And one person said, it's about all of us. It's about love of country. It's about love of the game. It's about perseverance, forgiveness, joy, sadness, success, failure. In other words, it's a human story. And because I believe that in telling my own story, I would encourage other people to tell their stories. And all of our stories together is the American story that has as its most powerful attribute our common humanity. And we must never forget that. So that's what it is. And how did it happen? Good question. I gave my political papers to Princeton, and they did an oral history and interviewed about 50 people. And so I had a reception for all 50 people, 40 showed up, and I stood up and told stories about each one of the 40. And at the end of which, a friend of mine who's produced 72 plays on Broadway came up to me afterwards and said, sounds a little bit like Hal Holbrook, you gotta work something up. And so for 2 years, I wrote it. And then for a year, I took it on the road to 20 cities around the country and read it and got responses from people. Then COVID hit. The idea was I was going to do this in theaters around the country. And instead, I rented a theater, a signature theater on 42nd Street for 4 nights in 2021. And we had 5 cameras and did it. And that's now the film that is on YouTube, Rolling Along. And one of the interesting things, for me at least, was that at each step along the way, an angel appeared. For example, in one of those 20 cities, I did it in the commissary of the Warner Brothers lot in California. And a guy came up afterwards and said, I think this could be a film. We ought to talk about it. His name was Mike Tolan, who did The Last Dance about Michael Jordan. And he said, let me help. So he became the director. And then every day I said, but I have to memorize it? Yeah, you gotta memorize it. Okay, an hour and 50 minutes at that point, cutting out of 92 minutes. And so I did that walking around Central Park. And then after I had it memorized, I had to do it every day to work out. So at 3:30 every day in the rec room of our apartment building, I would do the show for whoever came. And kind of got around 2 people, 4 people, 8 people, 9 people. I'd do the show. Nobody was there. I'd do it anyway because I had to work out. And one day, 2 people walk in, a woman and a man. And the man's name is Frank Oz. And he hears me do it. He says, yeah, I'd like to help you. So he became an executive producer and made a serious contribution to the effort. And then I called my buddy Spike Lee and said, hey, Spike, I've done this one-man show. He said, well, come on over to Brooklyn and do it for me. And I said, okay. And he said, what do you need? And I said, how about a glass of water and a stool? And so I go over and do it for him. And at the end of which, when I see that he has tears in his eyes, I think, well, maybe I got something here. And so angels appeared along the way. Now I'm 2 weeks out from Tribeca, which was the place that was going to debut. And I began the film with a Van Morrison song called And the Healing Has Begun, because that's what I hoped the film would do, create some healing in the country. His agent calls 2 weeks before and says, Van won't give you permission to use the film. So what am I going to do? So I call my buddy Steve Van Zandt on E Street Band, and I'd sent him the film 6 months earlier, and I said, hey, Steve, I need a song. He said, well, Bruce did a song in the early 80s called Summer in Signal Hill. See if it works. It did work. And so at every step along the way, there were angels that helped make this where it is today on YouTube. And I was on Max for 6 months, but then I decided I didn't want people to have to pay for it. I wanted it to be available to anybody who wanted to watch it. And so that's where it is.
Well, if any of you haven't seen it, Rolling Along is after the Mississippi River where Bill grew up. And if you haven't seen it, you know, watch it tonight or tomorrow. It is just that good. You mentioned Spike Lee. One of the themes throughout is race, not just in basketball, but in your political life and growing up in Crystal City, Missouri. So talk a little bit about race in America and how it's evolved and where we are now, Bill.
Well, it's come a long way from my childhood, where basically I remember when our Little League team went to the sectional finals in Joplin, Missouri, we stayed in a flea bag hotel because our 2 black players couldn't stay in a first class hotel. And things have changed dramatically since that time. And I believe that one of the things I care most deeply about is race. And I talk about it at some length in the film. Partly because of my teammates on the Knicks that became very, very close friends over many, many years. And partly because I have eyes and can see and think we're better than we've been and we can get better than we are. And that's always been the way I've felt about this issue. It's a very personal issue for me. Just as we're speaking now, one of the things I'm trying to do is find a plane for Dick Barnett, who is old Nick, because he's just been named to the Hall of Fame. And he's going to be inducted in Springfield, Massachusetts. And the problem is he's in a nursing home in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I've got to figure out a way to get his nurse and his guardian to Springfield, Massachusetts with him. So, in other words, these relationships span a lifetime and include a lot of things. So I look at it and think that I've been very fortunate.
Jump in this conversation, James.
Well, Senator, we're talking about, Senator Brady does a thing, I get it on 124 on a satellite, the POTUS channel, called American Voices. And Senator, tell us how long you've been doing this, how many people you've interviewed, and give this audience a sense of what you've learned after all of this.
Yeah. Well, James is referring to a radio program I've done now for about 17 years on Sirius XM called American Voices. And it's about the American people. And I'm always curious about it. As a politician, I would always want to hear their stories, and I'd repeat their stories, and I'd learn through the stories. And so I thought, well, why not bring this to a wider audience? And so I've done it now. We have over 1,400 interviews that we've done over that period of time, and they boil down into three categories. One is a category of somebody who has an unusual job, like a woman that goes into the Everglades and captures pythons and brings them out, right? Now, that's an unusual job. Or people who are doing something special in their community, like a guy that shines shoes at the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 26 years. And out of every tip, he put a portion of that tip into a fund to pay for poor kids' health care. And the day I interviewed him, he put over $100,000 into that fund. And the latter category reveal the goodness of the American people. And that's what I wanted to do. I mean, we hear so much about, and at first, the unusual job, the inventiveness, the creativity of the American people. And we hear so much negativity. And yet, you look at people out there in your life that you know, you've encountered in 100 different places, and they have a story, and that story is, by and large, a great story. Not always, a lot of pain in the world, no question about that. But so I have these two kinds of interviews, people that are doing something special in their community, people who have unusual jobs, and then the third interview type is just somebody I want to interview, right? So I called up Bonnie Raitt, one of my favorite singers. Hey, can I interview you? Yeah, okay, come on. So we talked about her singing. I got my Nick teammates on there. I interviewed the swimming coach at Columbia University. I've interviewed people from all over that I wanted to interview because they either meant something to me personally. I'm about to, as a matter of fact, and I'll give you a little late breaking news, I'm about to interview my dear, dear friend, John McPhee, who is a writer of New Yorker, 26 books. And I've always been a little intimidated, but I'm going to take the leap and I'm going to interview him about what he does, his writing, and how he does it. And for me, the radio program allows me to convey to people the kind of stories I've heard on the road for 50 years as a politician, as a basketball player, as a investment banker, as a person. And I continue to do them. I just signed up for another 2 years. So Channel 124, noon, Sundays.
James, yeah, I want you to continue.
James, you don't have to ask more than one question. You understand?
No. I'm going to let James take it over. But
I'll point out
that John McPhee wrote in 1963 a New Yorker piece. Was it a profile of a Princeton junior named William Bradley? So you've known Mr. McPhee for some time.
Since 1964.
Go ahead.
I just want to say I'm very pleased to be here tonight because it allows me to continue my current crusade. And that is to bring the tie back to the male world.
So, since I think our paths first crossed in 1988 when you were the United States Senator from New Jersey, and I was a campaign manager of then Senator Frank Lautenberg, who was running for re-election. Before I get to the question, I got to tell you a story. And it said Senator Bradley's raised some money for Senator Lautenberg, so I go to his Senate office, and he said, "Come here, we got to walk outside." So I said, "All right." So I followed Senator Bradley outside, and we go to the green place between the Capitol and the Supreme Court. And he hands me $7,500 worth of checks. He says, you know, it's against the law for me to hand you this check in the building. So we had to go leave the building so you could give me the check. That's a man, that's a straight man right there. I got to tell you, I've been around politics a lot. This guy shoots straight.
So, Senator, I remember that, James.
I remember it like yesterday. I'll never forget it. So one of your...
And he gave Frank Lautenberg $7,300.
I didn't know who shot it. In the Louisiana legislature, they had to get an envelope with $400 in it because they didn't know if they were shorted $100 or $600 because no one ever bribed anybody with $400. But one of your fleeting but major accomplishments was you actually shepherded tax reform through, I think it was 1986.
That's true.
And, of course, it's like, I thought we'd bought, when Ehud Barak won in Israel in 1999, I thought we'd bought peace to the Middle East. Well, I'm like, we did no such thing. I think you thought you reformed the tax code. Now, remember what you said, ants, they're like ants. They'll just come back in the door. We'll do this. Now, I think you were, unfortunately, very perceptive. But there's a book out I want to air, because you were in at the same time that President Reagan is, and Max Boot has a book on Reagan, and he's a conservative-leaning guy, but his general point is President Reagan was more of a spectator of history and things kind of happened on his watch. Was he very involved in your effort to get tax reform through, or what was the relationship you had?
No, he wasn't very involved. I was in two meetings with him, but he had very able lieutenants. Jim Baker, for example, was the Secretary of Treasury, and he had very able lieutenants who knew him well enough to know what he wanted, but he wasn't in the room strategizing whether we should do depreciation at this or that or how much you're going to do for this credit or that. But it is, and that was clearly the biggest legislative accomplishment of my 18 years. We cut the rates from 50 to 28 and didn't increase the deficit by eliminated loopholes that allowed us to not increase the deficit. And it lasted about 2 or 3 years because the ants started coming back. And somebody would come, well, we need to have this little exclusion or credit in there. Okay, well, the rates got to go up then if you don't want to increase the deficit. So the stuff came back, the rates went back up, and we lost the top rate of 28%. But I did have my first intense encounter with Donald Trump during those years. Now, he'd, you know, he got a casino in New Jersey, but I was never a match of a casino man. So I had no real contact with him there. He was state supervised anyway. But he's a big real estate guy. And a lot of the loopholes that we eliminated to get the rate down to 28% for everybody were real estate tax loopholes. And so he put me on his enemies list. And I wear that badge with great pride. And then to make it bipartisan, he put Lowell Weicker, the Republican senator from Connecticut, on. So Lowell Weicker and I were on his enemies list. But yeah, tax reform. And, you know, here we are today, and I see Kamala Harris. She wants to raise taxes on the wealthy. Fine. But, you know, there's a stupid way to do that and a smart way to do that. The stupid way to do that is just raise the rates, right? The smart way to do it is eliminate the loopholes that the wealthy use to avoid paying tax, because you can raise the rate up here, but if the loopholes are still there, it's still not going to pay tax. So I figure that'll be a conversation I'll have with Kamala and her Treasury Secretary after the election.
We got to talk a little basketball. I want you to talk
you said we would never talk.
I want you to talk about that special Nick, those special Nick teams you were on. But let me first say, I was lucky enough several times to have lunch, this is 20 years ago, with Red Auerbach through my friend John Feinstein. And one time I asked him, who is the greatest basketball player ever? And he said Michael Jordan. But he said...
Said who?
He said Michael Jordan. But he said, if I had to start a team, the first person I would have is Bill Russell. So I want to get your take on that and then talk about your Knick teams.
No question, if I started a team, it'd be with Bill Russell. He was the biggest winner in terms of his mentality and the most subtle psychological person, a player that I ever played against. I remember in my rookie year, I hardly got into games, but I finally got into a game against the Celtics, and we were I hit a couple of shots, and we were coming back, and there was a foul called. Russell's here on this side of the lane, and I'm over here on this side of the lane. And next to me is Sash Saunders, who's the guy who's trying to guard me and at that time. And so Russell looks at me, looks at Sash, looks at me, looks at Sash, and says, "Come on, Sash. Come on, you ought to be able to take care of this rummy." Right? But Russell was a very intense champion, and that's why he has so many rings. Michael Jordan, I would say, was equally competitive. But, you know, maybe I'm old school, maybe I'm old guy, so I picked the old guy. Michael Jordan is certainly would be on my team for sure.
So talk about your Knick teams.
Okay.
There was a remarkable chemistry, wasn't there?
The old Knicks or the new Knicks?
No, the 70-73 Knicks.
Yeah. We had a team that respected each other as human beings, that was unselfish, that knew that if we won, we only won because each of us helped each other become as good as we could be. And it was this very special group of human beings, too, as I mentioned earlier about the Barnett thing. And two are gone now. Dave, of course, my roommate, Dave DeBuscher, and Willis Reed, both of those are gone. I think about them all the time. There's a Bruce Springsteen song called Bobby Jean, and maybe somebody in the audience knows it, but every time I play it, I think of Dave DeBuscher. And so we played together. We had incomparable unselfishness, and we were highly, highly competitive. And we never wanted to lose, and we helped each other out. So now the current Knicks, I must say that Brunson did something that really, really impressed me. And that is not go to Villanova, by the way, but he decided this year that he was going to give up a couple of million dollars that he could have gotten in his contract so that there would be more money under the cap to get other good players and make the team better so the Knicks would have a better chance. If for no other reason than that, and of course my Knick pedigree, history, devotion, it makes it, I'm with them all the way, I would be totally for the Knicks because of that act on his part. How often do you see that happen? You don't. Yeah. And the media just, you know, that was a one-day story. Yeah, tell me about it, media. If you give up $2 or $3 million, tell me how it's a one-day story. Tell your wife you have a one-day story.
You know,
I just gave up $2 or $3 million. What?
You can pick on Villanova. They are the Nova Knicks, though. They have probably. Anyway, James, go ahead.
I think on that Knicks team, you had Willis Reed and Don Chaney.
Don Chaney.
He wasn't on it?
No, he was the enemy.
He was the enemy.
Nice try, James.
Oh, nice try.
He was a Celtic.
They were both from Louisiana.
He was the only Celtic I ever had a...
Okay. So, but
Willis Reed. Hold me back.
All right, so one-fifth was Louisiana. I know we got to turn it over to schedule, but to questions, but just in 2013 NBA All-Star game was in New Orleans, and Bill Russell and Bob Pettit were talking in a corner, and no one would get within 20 feet of them.
Right.
I mean, it just would not approach them, ask them for an autograph, anything. I mean, those were two great basketball players. Now, Bob Pettit, I saw him not very long ago at Jay's Barbecue in Baton Rouge.
Really?
He was a banker. Bob must be like 90 by now.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was, you know, my childhood hero. I grew up outside St. Louis. He was a Fox. And he was somebody that I admired greatly. And when I was in politics, he would do things for me that I asked him to help out in some way. And he's a great gentleman, too. And I'll never will forget that 57 NBA Finals. You remember that, of course, Al, don't you?
What St. Louis beat Boston.
You were in grade school then.
I remember it.
I do, too.
It was against Celtics versus the St. Louis Hawks. And he, Pettit played an incredible series, and they actually beat the Celtics the last time they were able to do that.
Yeah.
And, that was real Russell's, I think, his rookie year.
Somebody make a note to get a clip of this, and I want to send it to the Pettit family. But we'll take care of it.
I want you all to start coming up and asking questions. There's a microphone on the left, the right. Try to make your questions short. I would just say while you're doing that, that in that lunch with Auerbach, Bill, you had told me that the Boston Garden had dead spots on the floor. And I
Boston.
Mentioned that to Auerbach, and he had a very simple answer. Bullshit.
Well, I must say, I respect Red Auerbach, but I totally disagree with him. There were definitely dead spots on the floor. Bing, bing, with balls down here. Just don't go around half court or down the left side. But the worst thing about the Boston Garden was the locker room. Here we are. We are NBA champions, and we're going to the Boston Garden. They have a locker room that's about as big as maybe a third of this stage. I mean, it's maybe you and I and James. And you'd get there early, and so you'd be in the locker room, and you'd say, oh, it's tiny and hot, and I got to get a breath of fresh air. So you walk out in the hallway, and here would be the whole Celtic fan base lined up. Boo! You no good! You go back in the locker room. That's Boston Garden to me.
All right, I'm going to go to my left first because I'm more comfortable and ask, try to make your question short. And we've let Senator Bradley off the hook on politics so far, so you guys do a better job than we've done on that.
This question is for James. Most will remember your important instruction during the 92 campaign of "It's the economy, stupid." If you had a chance to put a placard in front of Kamala on her desk right now, what would it say?
Good question.
It's a very good question. I'm asked that a lot. First of all, I'll make a general point. Views on the economy are not static. They evolve. And I think this rate cut today, I'm hoping that that gives people a sense that interest rates are coming down, because I think this economy is very good for people like me and most people in this audience who are net savers. I think it's not a good economy for net borrowers. And when we say, when we tell people it is good and it goes against the experience, my economic message for the vice president would be, you're at the point where you have something to lose. If you start willy-nilly adding tariffs and deporting people and stopping immigration, you're going to choke off what progress we've made so far. And we're starting to see some progress. And I know that's not as clear a message I would like, but I think if we're going to be successful on this, we have every reason to scare the crap out of people, because what he's proposing, I know Senator Bradley, I'm almost confident that you'd agree with me, that tariffs and cutting off immigration would be death to this economy.
No, well.
Yeah, yes.
Well, the tariffs would be a giant tax. I mean, tariffs are not paid by foreign nations, which is what he says. They're paid by us as prices go up. And that's just the reality. And, you know, your conversation earlier made me think about how close this race is.
Very close.
And it really is close. And that's why I think what is often ignored is the effort that is made to register people and get them out to vote will determine this election. And there are a number of organizations doing that. In 2020, I actually worked with an organization, a couple of very generous friends of mine funded them. And we were able to get people who moved into a state from another state, and not registered, but they were Democratic. And we get them registered and get them out to vote. And the number that we were able to turn out was the margin of victory in Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin. That group is doing the same thing now. Do you realize there are over 250,000 people in Pennsylvania who are not registered, who if they were registered, would be Democrats? So are you going to spend money on TV ads? Or are you going to spend money on identifying them and getting them out to the polls? And I think that it's the ground game, the ground game, the ground game. And I don't think the Republicans have the discipline or the interest in doing that. And we've got it honed to a degree that's really quite impressive. So I think that's the unknown element to this thing.
My more optimistic message, I want to give him a short answer. Yeah. My optimistic answer would be, it's time to turn the page and just leave it at that. And let people draw whatever conclusion they want. Go ahead.
Over here.
My question is for Mr. Carville, but I just have to say, with respect to Senator Bradley, that, like I suspect many people in this room, I remember May 11th, 1970, watching that game and Willis coming out for the famous two shots. I'll get there, okay?
That's okay. Bill doesn't mind you going on for a while on this.
All right, but I do have to say that Russell's rookie year was 56, and in 57, he had a scratch cornea. My question for Mr. Carville, who...
You learn something every day.
Okay, you're angry? My question for Mr. Carville is, and I remember you once telling me I'm a liberal, not a leftist, isn't it possible, I haven't seen a sister soldier moment from the vice president, isn't it possible that one of the reasons that the race is tied is that she is viewed by a significant portion of the persuadable electorate as fundamentally a San Francisco progressive, and that the Democratic Party is much further to the left than it was under President Clinton? That's my question.
So May 11th, 1970, I was working on an oil rig offshore Louisiana coast, working 12 hours, 8 days, well, no, it was like 10 days on, 5 days off, I remember it well. I think that she has gone a long way, and I think that's one of the reasons that she picked Governor Walz as her running mate. I loved Governor Shapiro. He's a great guy. He's a good friend of mine. But I think a San Francisco-Philadelphia combination might have given off some of that. Or I thought her performance at the convention was really good. I don't know if you can address that kind of issue directly, but I think that it's a problem. And look, coastal people have for too long given the impression to people in the rest of the country that there's an air of superiority. And you can't deny that. The rest of the country feels that. And she has to be very, very careful. And I think the Walz pick was an acknowledgement that the problem that you identified. So I think your question is right on, and I think they're aware of it.
Yeah, I would just add one thing that I'm impressed by. She's not playing identity politics. Neither did Obama. I think, to an unfortunate extent, Hillary Clinton did in 2016. She doesn't have to say, I will be the first black woman president. That's kind of obvious, isn't it? And I think she's really done that very, very well so far. Over here.
Yep. This is a question for whoever would like to address it. Why have we reached a point where the two political parties seem to have decided that they're not going to compete in a realistic way in 43, 44 states, so that it's down to the people of six or seven states, maybe 20% of the total population, and everybody else's vote is more or less symbolic.
Bill Bradley, why don't you take that?
Why don't you take that question?
Why don't I take it? Well, I think that if enough people in a state that is not in those seven didn't vote, those would suddenly be at risk. And these states are just, they have, you know, two parties that are very close, and there's a history of that. That's the way it's been. There are always, you have a 50-state race, but you don't have a 50-state competition, if you know what I mean. And I think that you've always had certain states that are critical. No Republican in the old days worried about the South. It was all the Democratic, right? And I think that that's got a change. That's changed. And so these states, for whatever reason, are the ones where there are a significant number of people who are undecided. And it's very close. And the Electoral College, of course, is determining that. It's not the popular vote. If it was the popular vote, you'd stay in New York and in California and Texas, and you'd run up the popular vote. But it's the Electoral College, so it's state by state. And as state by state, these are the ones that are the closest. And I don't lament that. That's the way it is.
So I describe myself as a liberal, not a leftist. The worst thing you can say about leftist Democrats, in my mind, is they're kind of naive. They want to change dictionaries. I want to change laws. But they're basically, I think, naive people. When 65% of Republicans think that January 6th was a tourist visit, you are approving of criminality. There is a difference between naivety and criminality, a big difference. A lot of us have been naive at one point in our life. Most of us have not been criminals.
Okay, quick question for James. Your wife has not been out and about as much. I hope she's doing okay. And my family and I were curious what her position on the upcoming election is, if you would be willing to share that.
You know, I've been married for 31 years, and I let my wife speak for her. And I think a lot of people in this audience can understand that.
You want to make 32.
Yeah. I'm not her. And people call her and say, can you get James to do this? And she says, you want James to do something, you call James. I'm not his goddamn scheduler. So don't. But anyway, no. She's a very independent person, and I'll let her speak for herself. But she's a beekeeper now.
Over here.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for this insightful discussion. My question is, it seems like that both vice presidential nominees on the tickets are drawing an outsized amount of attention compared to prior elections. And I'm wondering, do you think that they're having an impact on voters' opinions or in pushing them towards one side or the other, or is it all sort of a wash?
I'll start with that. No, I don't. I think J.D. Vance has probably caused a few problems. But look, vice presidents, they matter when they're picked. They matter when you get the first impression. The last vice president that actually delivered something was Lyndon Johnson in 1960. So I don't think that either Vance, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, do I write about their debate on October 1? Does it matter? So, I don't know, maybe Bill and James have a different view, and I think you can do harm, but even that is exaggerated. In 1988, there was a debate, and maybe the most, you know, devastating line I've ever heard was Lloyd Benson saying to, when Dan Quayle had invoked Jack Kennedy, I knew Jack Kennedy, he was a friend of mine, you're no Jack Kennedy, but guess what? The Republicans carry Texas. So I would hope James and Bill would disagree with me, but I don't think it matters much.
To me, the question is not, is the vice president determinative? No, you vote for the person who's going to have his finger on the nuclear or her finger on the nuclear button. But there is some value to having two people who obviously like each other. I mean, Dan Quayle and George Bush, it was kind of oil and water. They didn't. But Tim Walz and Kamala Harris, you can see the interaction. But more importantly, you can see the complementarity of their personalities. And I think that his presence on the ticket helps her by shaping who she is in people's minds that she could have chosen, such a son of the Midwest and such a straightforward guy. And I think that the debate between J.D. Vance, who I've known for at least a decade, and Walz, I think Walz will do extremely well. J.D. will be the smartest kid on the block, but Walz will be the one that somehow or another you remember the most. And to me, that's the only thing you can, you got the best of all worlds with a vice president. If the vice president can do something, say, I like him.
So in that 10 years, what's your view of J.D. Vance?
Let's move on.
This is a question for James Carville. There's been a lot of reporting about newly registered voters. Are the polls reflecting the newly registered voters, in your opinion?
Generally, yes. I mean, the pollsters are not that stupid. They'll ask the question when they call, and that's a cell phone, or they do a lot online and stuff like that, but they have what they call a screen. And if you're not registered, now people lie. And if you have time, you would, you know, you could ask that. But you could also get the list of newly registered voters, and they're sophisticated enough to even just call newly registered voters if they want to. But in my mind, every voter that's registered is the same, whether they've been registered for a week or whether they've been registered, in my case, for 60-something years. And you can look at party ID by registration, and it's instructive. But I don't have a big distinction between newly registered and overly registered. They're all voters to me.
Over here.
I was asking that question only because I wondered if they were capturing those numbers and that would change the dynamic of being tied.
A good pollster should capture registered voters. They'll ask you. Now, they generally won't ask you how long you've been registered, but you have to answer affirmative to I'm registered. Then they'll follow it up on how likely you are to vote. There's a whole screen that you have to go through to pass muster. But
They draw their respondents from the voter file now more than phone calls or increasingly online. But I think the pollsters, they made some bad mistakes in 16, but I think they're more accurate. The good ones are far more accurate than not.
But there is the fact in Pennsylvania of 250,000 people who are not registered, and they have about 3 or 4 weeks to get registered. So if the screen is you're a registered voter, they'd have to say no. But they could be saying yes in a three-week period of time. So that's reason to hope.
So go to Pennsylvania and start registering those people. This side.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Frederick Bell, weekly listener to the Politics War Room with James Carville and Al Hunt. And I was going to call myself a former student of James Carville, but tonight I think we're all students of James Carville. So I want to thank him for that. My question is for Senator Bradley. The Republican Party has changed a lot, I think, since you were very active in the space. What do you think Ronald Reagan would say about today's Republican Party?
Well, he would just say, I don't understand the party today. I think that Ronald Reagan would be appalled by Donald Trump. Appalled by Donald Trump. Now, some of the conservative positions he had, but there was a kind of charitable nature. He had a human nature that made him approachable. And he surrounded himself with people who understood that was his strength, and they then buttressed what they thought he wanted to do. So I think Ronald Reagan would be appalled at what the Republican Party has become, even though some of the positions that they have taken are consistent with what he would have taken, but there's a whole atmosphere that is different, and it's set from the top, not by the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader. It's set by the candidate or for president, the president, or the former president.
Yeah, I'll give you a precursor. Is my former student Allison Hirsch here? Oh, she's back there. I was coming back from your wedding and with my wife in 2008. Well, this was a precursor. And my wife is Judy Woodruff, and she got a, this was right after the Republican convention, John McCain's convention, and she got a call from Nancy Reagan, who she had known because she'd done a documentary. And the first question was, why did John pick that woman? Ronald Reagan often thought what Nancy Reagan thought, and I think Bill's right. He would have been turned off by it.
So Frederick was one of my students, but more importantly, he was from Carville. And Frederick and I might be two of the three college graduates in the history of Carville, Louisiana.
Frederick, I thought you had a tie on, but you don't. So
my apologies for not wearing a tie.
So. You failed Bill Bradley's test. Over here.
This question is for whoever would like to answer it. I just want to give credit to my grandpa. He has been the state historian for South Carolina. So if Trump loses the election and the Republican leadership finally decides to cannibalize him, assisted by the courts, how does the Republican Party recreate itself after Trump?
I'll start, and then both of you pick up. I don't think this is like 1964. I think that the Trumpism is so embedded in the Republican Party today. You just look at the candidates in various states. You look at the state legislatures, the gerrymandered state legislatures. I don't think if Trump is defeated, roundly on the that he will be, but if he is, I don't think suddenly people will have a come-to-Jesus meeting. What are we going to do? I think Trump will still dominate that. Trumpism will still dominate that party. But Bill and James disagree.
Yeah, I think that Trump didn't invent a movement. I think the movement was there, and he came in and sort of captured what they were thinking. And unfortunately, the only possible way that that actuarial tables will have a lot to do with it. Unfortunately, none of us up here are going to live to see that. And I kind of agree with Al. I used to think maybe a big defeat would cure it, but I think this is powerful forces that Trump has. I think he saw it, he marshaled it, and he gave it sort of purpose. And I wish I had a more optimistic view on it, but I think it's going to be around for a while, unfortunately.
Bill?
I think if he goes, is defeated, there's a chance for the Republican Party to turn the page. And whether they'll do that or not, I'm not the expert on.
Remember, Senator, page can turn backwards as easy as it can turn
forward. Yeah, I got it.
I forgot whether I'm going to my right or my left, but I'll go to my left and see who's there.
Thanks again, guys, for doing this. This has been a great talk. My question is for James about the demographic of men, voting age males, 35 to 18, that are finding a home in the voices of like Tulsi Gabbard and RFK, a lot of the conspiracy theorists that Trump surrounded himself with. What does the Democratic Party do from now till Election Day and then after that to kind of bring them back into the fold?
We have a male problem. I was pretty kind of vocal about it. People got a little put out with me for some of the things I said. But 48% of people who vote are male. But that's just a fact. And, we can celebrate that we do better. We certainly do better with female voters than they do, but they do better with male voters than we do. But I'm going to make a prediction in this cycle. Every cycle has a key demographic. NASCAR dads, soccer moms, okay, et cetera. I think the demographic with the most elasticity, that means that we can run ahead of our traditional performance, are actually white college males. Now, the reason I say that, I have two reasons for saying it. One, they are significantly more pro-choice than non-college white males. And number two, because of just the way the economic circumstances are in the United States, they tend to be more vested in the markets. And they would likely feel the updraft we've had in the markets. And I mean, look, do I think it's going to be anything dramatic? No. But if you move a couple of 3 points in a demographic that large, you move a lot. And it's not a fashionable or trendy prediction to make, but I think that's the demographic. Post-bachelor white women are 80% Democratic. We don't have a lot of elasticity there. Columbia Law School female, we got them.
Bill Bradley, you want to pick up on that? Having faced male voters? No. Okay.
So, first, Senator Bradley, this is not a prop. Thank you for wearing a tie. Maybe,
wow.
Maybe you want to reconsider the bright red, but I'll let you decide. My question is for all three, but predominantly Mr. Carville. How do you maintain family harmony? And I know it's been said, and I want to hear from all three of you, but I know it's been said that you don't talk about politics at home. Personally, I don't believe it, but maybe you want to share exactly what you do.
Yeah, but first, yeah, I got a bright red on. You got a pea yellow on, that's for sure.
It's actually a Knicks orange, but that's okay.
Yeah,
you want to duck this one too, James?
No, I don't. We talk about it some. It's been my wife is, I'll rise in her defense. She's really a Republican, and she was very close. She was Vice President Cheney's top aide. I mean, she literally would prepare him for Meet the Press, would prepare him for the debates with John Edwards. She's very close. We used to spend the holidays at Jackson Hole because she would staff him when he was vice president. I feel for people because this turmoil, to say the least, Liz Cheney doesn't think very much of Trump. So I try to not make a difficult situation any more difficult for her. But I can assure you she's not a Democrat.
You've done that very well tonight. You know, we have time for one more question, but one of the most just telling scenes was after, I guess it was in 2022, I think, or maybe late 2021, the House of Representatives decided to honor the Capitol Hill police who had so valiantly fended off the insurrections that day. There were only two Republicans who showed up on the House floor, Liz Cheney and her father. Not a single other Republican showed up. I mean, if that doesn't tell you everything about how far that party has come, to my great, I mean, there were people that Bill served with, like Howard Baker and Richard Lugar and Bob Dole, they weren't these kind of Republicans. We have to have a really good one over here. This is the final question. A lot of pressure on you.
So
he has a tie on, too, Bill.
I have my tie on. First of all, I think the attributes given to Senator Bradley are lower than he deserves. I saw him when they won the championship in 70. I bought tickets for $5 to see the four games. Greatest game ever was the fifth game. That was the greatest game. Forget the seventh game, the fifth game. Mr. Carville, I have a question for you. When you take a poll, when I get, let's say, deluged with requests, am I supporting Kamala Harris? If I try to hit yes, I immediately go down the rabbit hole to how much are you giving? What poll will the Democrats ever run that just asked a freaking question without asking for money?
Well, I get all these polls on, you know, I get a lot. I I'm on the Trump text chain, and I can't hit the stop because it's all so goddamn crazy. There's a lot of that stuff where they said, tell us your opinion and then send us a check. Real Pope, that's not a Pope. Just throw that away. As soon as you see anything financial with a question, just throw it out. Or you may just want to see what it is.
We're going to save you a lot of money.
Yeah. But I send out a gazillion emails laughing with Senator Bradley and Al Hunt and said, you know, I got an email. Sometimes I'm in the airport and I'll have, like, usually a lady comes up and says, you know, James, I taught third grade for 25 years, and I answered your email, and you didn't answer me back. That's not right. I said, oh, my God, I wasn't raised right. I send so many of those things out, I have no idea where they're coming from.
You guys have been in wonderful...
Could I say something?
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Honorable.
Oh, thanks. I'd like to leave people with the following thought. That maybe, given the last questioner, maybe we could learn something in the divided country that we're in from what made the NIC teams great so many years ago. Take responsibility for yourself, respect your fellow human being, disagree with them openly and honestly, enjoy their humanity, and never look down on people you don't understand.
That's a wonderful way to end what has been just a fabulous evening. Thank you all so much. We appreciate it.